Hello everyone, welcome to our The Week That Was in Europe podcast. My name is Dirk Schumacher, I'm the head of European Macro Research at Natixis, and with me, as usual, is Klaus Adam, Professor of Economics at the University of Mannheim.
Hello also from my side. So today we want to discuss with Francesco Chavazzi about the economic and political situation in Italy. Francesco is professor of economics at Bocconi University, but has been going back and forth between academia and politics a couple of times in his long and quite distinguished career. Most recently, Francesco was part of Mario Draghi's government in Italy and widely seen as being the closest and perhaps most important economic advisor to Prime Minister Draghi. And the rumor is that he was also an influential advisor during Mario Draghi's time at the ECB. This said, Francesco has a long history of policy advising. Already in the 1990s, he was Director General of the Italian Treasury and as such responsible for debt management and the ongoing privatizations at the time in Italy. And in the late 1990s, he was a member of the Council of Economic Advisers to the then Italian Prime Minister Massimo D'Alema. So today we want to look at some of the achievements of the Draghi government and also discuss the current situation under the new Italian government of Prime Minister Meloni. So after this long introduction, welcome to the show, Francesco. We are very pleased to have you with us.
Welcome and thank you very much for inviting me.
So let's start with some more near-term current events. Italy looks to be doing well, especially in comparison to France, Germany and Spain, in terms of post-pandemic recovery. So Italian GDP is now roughly 2% above its pre-pandemic level, compared with just 1.2% for France, 0.1% for Germany, and minus 0.9% for Spain. So what explains this relative outperformance of the Italian economy? Was this due to policy choices? Was it due to luck? And can it last?
Well, you should never rule out luck, but I think policy choices have been important in, I would say, two dimensions. One has been the very rapid reaction of the Draghi government, both to the COVID that we found when we went in government, and to the ensuing energy crisis. That's point number. So the speed in addressing this, when Mario Draghi came in government, the vaccination process in Italy was very slow. It was accelerated significantly, and that helped a lot. And on energy, I think we understood very early on, the first week of March last year, a few weeks after the start of the war, that there was a need to diversify energy supply, both in terms of sources of energy, whether gas or other sources, and in terms of suppliers, replacing Russia with other suppliers. So the fact that action on these fronts, in my view, happened very fast was important. The second, more macro reason, is that we pushed on the idea that fiscal policy was to be used to soften the impact of the war, the pandemic, on domestic demand, on consumption and investment, and that even if you spend a lot of public money on subsidies for households and firms, if this keeps the economy alive, then at the end the debt to GDP ratio falls because the denominator rises. So when we started, the debt to GDP ratio was above 150%. Now it's 135, so it was reduced by 20%. Now, admittedly, part of this reduction is due to the nominal income rising because inflation has come up, but certainly 20% reduction in debt to GDP ratio is something that was important also to keep markets calm vis-a-vis the Italian debt. So maybe I stop here.
You already addressed the question I'm now asking, but I'd like to hear a bit more details on the Italian energy system, or the, if you will, the how the energy resources can be distributed. Italy was more or less as reliant as Germany on Russian gas, but seemed to have managed to transition away quicker. Again, why was that? And secondly, what does the Italian energy system of the future look like?
So Italy runs more than other European country on gas. So 90% of energy comes from gas, and of that amount of gas, of that 90%, before the war, 40% was coming from Russia. So almost a half. So the first so there were two actions, as I mentioned before. One was reducing the amount, the dependence on gas, and there has been an acceleration of renewables, especially eolic has been. So the reason why renewables were not increasing fast was mostly because of constraint from local municipalities not wanting solar panel or eolic things in their backyards. That was sped up by transferring the power to start a plant away from the local regional administration to the central government. Now, of course, the central government had to do it with some caution, but this was a big speed up. The second, I think, the second maybe is luck. Italy is very close to the largest source of gas in Europe, which is the Mediterranean and the North Mediterranean shore in particular, and Algeria in particular. So we managed to increase very significantly the amount of gas coming from Algeria. So the overall outcome is that the 40% coming from Russia by the next winter will be down to zero. And now we are down to something around maybe 10-12%. So it'd be a dramatic reduction in the amount of gas coming from. How did we do that without stopping heating houses? Is by raising significantly, very significant amount of gas coming from Algeria. The pipes from Algeria were already there. Algeria has two main pipes. There is one coming to Italy, another one going to Spain. Spain, as you know, has an excess of gas because they have a large liquefaction capacity because they have a lot of plants to liquefy gas, and that excess capacity for Spain was used for domestic consumption in Spain, which opened up one of the pipelines from Algeria, which meant that in a very few months, maybe less than a couple of months, the amount of gas coming from Algeria doubled. Now here there is another element which is important, which goes back to the 1950s. The Italian energy company Eni has been present in Africa and in Algeria in particular, since the beginning, and the relationship with this country is very close. I think I traveled with Eni in Africa during last year, and what's amazing is that the reaction one has, the way one is received in these countries, is always very positive. They perceive the Italian energy company Eni as a collaborator, as a company that takes care of the gas that is owned by Algeria but is extracted thanks to Eni. So when we ask them, we have to increase this amount, the answer was very positive. But this goes back, as I say, to the to an energy policy from the 50s. So these two things, rapid reaction, understanding very fast what the war would have meant for energy supplies, trying to reduce the power of local authorities without making them too unhappy on in installing new plants, and increasing rapidly the amount of gas from essentially from Algeria, because then we went to Congo, to Nigeria, but all this is gas that comes liquefied, so it needs to be regasified. And there, we only have, as of today, three regasification plants. They will increase, but that was a what stopped that part of the flow.
That was certainly a better starting point than Germany, where there were actually zero regasification plants. Yeah. And they had to be built. And I think the German economy minister had a quite humbling experience traveling to Qatar at the time. And yeah, the welcome wasn't all too warm. Now let's move on to some of the more structural issues, because the Draghi government was also expected to do something on the structural front. So, you know, away from the emergencies that then hit suddenly. So where do you see that the Draghi government made progress with respect to structural reforms? Where would you see the biggest achievement, perhaps?
So here, the push was the Next Generation EU plan, because, as you know, the flow of funds from the plan is conditional upon reforms. And every year, now every 6 months, Italy gets about 20 billion euro every 6 months for the plan, conditional on the reforms being implemented. So far, we met all the signposts. Has that meant significant reforms? Here I'm more cautious. I don't think there was anything dramatic. There was a bit in competition by opening up auctions for local municipalities. Typically, Italian local municipalities, each of them owns a municipality-owned service company that provides water, electricity, and so on. So those have been opened up to competition. It is happening. It didn't happen overnight, but that was a bit. There was almost nothing in the labor market, because the labor market was not a big issue in the conditionality of the Next Generation EU funds. So we did the minimum, but the minimum was small. There was conditionality on education, but there again, was mostly about building new schools than changing the rules for teachers and so on. So there was not much. So what was asked was done, but it didn't change dramatically the situation.
But what about the judicial reform? Wouldn't you say that was one?
The judicial, or didn't they have... reform, yes, you're right. The judicial reform was a big issue, both for criminal justice and for civil justice. Here, I'm frankly not an expert. I observed, while in government, huge debates between the minister, who actually is a colleague from Bocconi, Marta Cartabia, who was trying to convince me that they were doing dramatic things for the judiciary, and observers of the reform that say, it looks big, but nothing much will in the end happen. I keep an open position. I didn't see so far dramatic changes. Yes, the conditionality for the Next Generation EU says, for example, that the average time it takes to come to a first degree judgment which in Italy is, I think, four times longer than in Germany, has to be reduced to the same level of Germany by the date that the Next Generation EU plan is finished, which is December 26. Are we going there? Yes, something is happening. I don't think fast enough, but again, I'm not an expert. Maybe Marta Cartabia has better views than me, and she's much more confident that this will happen. But this, you're right, this was a big issue.
Maybe we should invite her on the podcast.
Yes.
So nothing dramatic, you said, happened, but what do you think should happen? So where's the area where further structural reforms are needed most?
I think the area is the labor market. One of the constraints on Italian growth that has not hit all the way now, but is coming, is labor supply. So, for example, in the construction sector, because, as you know, Next Generation EU, a very large part, probably half the money, goes into a new railway system that connects the country, new high-speed railway system. There, the difficulty is that we need, I think the estimate is about 100,000 new blue-collar construction workers, high-skilled blue-collar construction workers, which don't exist in Italy. So there are two options. One is to import workers from Eastern Europe and train them. And this is what the companies themselves are doing. So the idea was that the government itself would set up training programs for immigrants from Eastern Europe. I think the plan is that someone who comes with a driving license in about 6 months can be put on a caterpillar to work on a caterpillar. That is happening very slowly because the process of selecting and admitting workers from Eastern Europe is still very cumbersome. The alternative is to train domestic workers. And here, what has been very slow is that this citizens' income that had been introduced by the five-star before the Draghi government and has remained because the five-star was part of the government coalition, essentially cushions Italian workers who, instead of enrolling in a program that teaches them how to drive a caterpillar, used this citizen income to survive. So that has been, so in both areas, I don't say that nothing has happened, but little has happened, and most of what has happened has been from the private sector companies. Now this, of course, is changing with this right-wing administration, but I'm worried that they're changing it in a dramatic, but I'm not sure whether sustainable way, because they're cutting citizens' income from the one day to the next, about a half by early March. And this, I'm afraid, will create social tension, because here you have a large number of people who rely on citizens' income. Half of them cannot work, because citizen income is directed to people who cannot have a normal job, either because of health condition or other reasons. So you cut it out and you don't eliminate the program. For the others, you need to accompany the reduction in citizen income, which with a different name, but all European countries have, with an acceleration of training programs, and this hasn't happened. So the supply of blue-collar workers remains a significant problem.
Yeah, so you mentioned we have now the new government, which is led by Prime Minister Meloni. And certainly in the rest of Europe, there were quite some concerns before this new government was coming into office last fall. In particular, many people have feared sort of a replay of the 2018 events
the arrival of a populist government that generates market nervousness and rising bond spreads. So far, at least, there are no signs of any of this. Markets remain calm, and that was a big surprise. Was it a surprise to you? And, will this last, or what do you think about it?
No, I was not surprised because while in government, Mrs. Meloni was the only person in the opposition. So we talked to her a lot because you have to talk to the opposition, and there was only one. I was not surprised because I'm convinced that she's in for the long, she and her party, but her party is essentially herself, are in for the long term. So they learned the lesson of the Five Star, which was a big fire very soon extinguished. They are in for the long term, and they understand that the main the main difficulty of being in for the long term is in economics, in the market reactions. If they do anything wrong on that in that area, they have the they end up like the Five Star from 30-35% to 12%. So they've been super careful in anything to do with the European Commission, in the deficit, in keeping on the previous commitment to the Next Generation EU plan and so on. So that has worked, and it's not surprising that it works. I'm a bit concerned that this is a party that has never been in government ever and has no people, essentially. There's no people who have been trained or have an experience of being in government. If you look at the composition of the government, apart from a few ministers who have some experience, but outside of government, there is very little. And as you know, the public sector in Italy is very large. The number of government-owned companies, all the energy sector, steel, and many other companies are controlled by the government. The government doesn't have 100% control, but has enough control, around 30%, to be able to decide the management of these companies. And unfortunately for Mrs. Meloni, there is a significant number of these companies whose board expires now in the spring. And I see that transition as very difficult because they need to appoint a very large number of managers. They have no managers that they know that have been close to the party because of the tradition of that party, but they will not give up because there is a lot of pressure from inside the party to have positions. And here what worries me is that we could end up with a management of these important companies that is not up to standards. I know Mrs. Meloni is aware of this, but for her it's difficult because she has to tell people in her party who have never been in government or in power position and that are waiting to have some relevant position. No, I cannot give it to you. I give it to someone who is closer to the opposition because they're better. And this is a difficult statement for her to make.
Let's now move on to some of the issues regarding the relationship between Italy and Europe. Italy is currently the last holdout on the reform of the European Stability Mechanism. So the ESM, after the German Constitutional Court rejected an appeal that could have prevented the German government from ratifying it. So Italy is the only one that still has to do that. What are the concerns in Italy about reformed European Stability Mechanism?
Okay, so Mrs. Meloni has always been strongly against the ESM. Now she has said in public that she's not going to keep this position, but she keeps repeating something that I think is correct, that apart from Spain and Portugal at the beginning and maybe Greece, nobody ever used the ESM. And one has to ask why the ESM is an instrument with a lot of potential power to use, and that is not used by essentially anybody. My view is that there is a stigma attached, because if you go to the ESM, you are telling the market that you've lost market access, because if you have market access, why should you need the ESM. And so I think in the end we will approve it, but we will remain in a situation where nobody uses it. So we have to ask ourselves, hasn't the time come to reform the ESM, but not the reform we are currently approving in the reform treaty, but a deeper reform that makes this instrument useful. So far, in my view, is useless, even after Italy will approve it.
But I guess it was OMT was never used. It wasn't useless, I would say, was it?
You're right, but it's different. It's different because OMT was an instrument essentially in the hands of the ECB. It is true that it had to go through the ESM, but I think the driving force was the ECB. Here, there is no pressure from anybody to use it. For example, in Italy, the amount of money we could draw from the ESM was targeted to improving the health system. But now we have from that Generation EU twice the money we could have from the ESM to reform hospitals and the health system in general. And we have difficulty in spending that money. So the last thing we need is the ESM money for the health system. So I think that another aspect is the coincidence with Next Generation. Next Generation EU is in Italy anything between 12 and 15% of GDP. So it's a huge amount of resources. And half of them grants and half of them at very low interest rates, especially now at very low interest rates. So I think there is very little pressure to use. So it's very different from the OMT situation.
Right. So some people tell me that Italy actually has some difficulties in actually absorbing the funds that come from Next Generation EU, and that there wouldn't be any, there would be no way one could accelerate Italian growth further by providing further support. Is that a view you would share? Or?
Well, it is true that the amount of, it is 15%, let's say 15% of GDP over 4 years, 4 years remaining. It's a lot of money to spend. Also because they're very precisely targeting, it's not money that can be spent anyway. Some of the actions are very hard to implement. For example, there's a large bunch of projects in agriculture that rely on electric tractors. Now there are no electric tractors to be bought if you go out to the market, so that part has to be redrafted. And Italy is in discussion with the Commission in redrafting what cannot be spent, but not because Italy is unable to spend it, but because the projects don't have enough stuff that needs to be bought to spend. There are other areas that where instead there are political issues. For example, a significant part of the program is on water. A well-known problem in Italy is the distribution of water, because half of the water doesn't get from where it comes from to the consumer, and of the half that doesn't get to the consumer or the firm, half is lost because the pipes are broken, and half is stolen because someone attaches his house to the pipe without being allowed to do it. Now, that's a bit more complicated because the water distribution system is run by a large number of municipal companies. So we were able to reduce the municipal companies and replace them with market companies in the energy sector, for example, distribution of gas or distribution of electricity. So that's working. We've been unable to do it on water because the local pressure is very strong. It needs to be done, and is one of the conditions of the Next Generation EU. That is happening slower than expected, but it is happening. But again, to go back to your initial point, spending 15% of all the 15% of GDP, even when we reallocate like the electrical tractors, will not be easy, and that. Although I think we'll get close to that, but that explains why there is very little interest in Italy in the ESM funds.
Okay, then and final question we would have, what's your take on the stability and growth pact that are currently discussed the reforms of it. Do you think that the fiscal framework as it stands is good, and what's needed there?
So first of all, the fact that the old rules need to be changed is obvious to everybody, almost to everybody. It is true, however, that one should not underweight the fact that there are many people around Europe who still think that the old rules should be reintroduced as they are. Interestingly, not only some governments from the north, the Netherlands, for instance, but also, and it's surprising, many in the administration. If you go to the Italian economy ministry, you go to the French Ministère de Finances, if you talk to the finance ministry in Germany, these are people, the functionaire, who have learned to live with these rules for a long time, and they know how to live with the rules. Now, on some part, they've learned how to avoid the rules. In other countries, they have learned how to live with countries that avoid the rules. But why should we change something that, in a way or another, seems to work? And that's a strong opposition, because these are many of the guys who are around the table to design new rules. My view is that they should be changed. And I was positively very surprised by the proposal of the Commission. So the Commission proposal of November is, I wrote an editorial on Corriere della Sera this morning calling it revolutionary, because it's a dramatic change, proposal for change in the rules, in the right direction, both in terms of moving away from numbers that are the same for all countries to bilateral negotiations between the Commission and the countries to adapt the debt reduction plans, for instance, to this particular situation of a country, and basing the debt reduction plans on an expenditure rule, which was not the case before we had deficit rules. The expenditure rules, which many economists have advocated in the past, has the advantage that it's not pro-cyclical, because it avoids that when a country enters a recession, to keep the deficit low, you raise taxes and therefore deepen the recession. So the expenditure rule on one side and the bilateral negotiation with the Commission on the other are, in my view, two revolutions. And the fact that this proposal was put on the table by the Commission with unanimity from the commissioners. Of course, unanimity from the Commission does not mean unanimity from the governments in the EU. For me, it was a big surprise. So my view, and what I'm telling the Italian government, is go there and say, we want to do what the Commission suggests one by one. There is no way to make it better.
Okay, I shall try a little summary now. Why has Italy outperformed so far? You said luck obviously cannot be discounted, but it was the fast response in terms of the COVID, but also the energy crisis, plus the aggressive use of fiscal policy, which prevented kind of negative feedback loops developing. Then the energy system, Italy was as dependent as Germany on gas, but accelerated significantly renewable energies by changing mostly the approval process, and of course the closeness to Algeria, and again a bit of luck helped here too. Structural reforms, the signposts of the next generation have been met, but you don't think they're dramatic or they would not qualify as significant reforms, and not much really in the labor market. And this is where you think actually the biggest need for additional reforms is. Labor supply, given the demographics and all that, will be a pressing problem, and that needs to be addressed. What explains the calmness of the financial markets? Well, you think it shouldn't be a surprise, given that Meloni is in for the long run, i.e. she understands or has learned from the mistakes from Five Star, and that keeping markets calm is a necessary condition if you want to stay in power for a long time. ESM, the European Stability Mechanism, the problem here is the stigma that comes along with it and the signal to financial markets. Finally, financial or the fiscal reform or the fiscal rules reforms, you are in favor of what the ECB, the European Commission, is proposing here, the bilateral negotiations and expenditure rules, you think is something that would be good and should be supported by the Italian government. Was it a fair summary?
Just perfect.
Then thanks. Thank you very much for your time, Francesco.
Thank you. I hope this is useful for our listeners.